Okay. Oh, yeah, it's working. Cool. So back again. So again, what we'll do is we'll do about another hour of lecture and then a second break, and then we'll do a final half hour and we'll be out of here for the evening. One of the things that came up during the break, and something I should have mentioned, a couple of things actually. One is, some of you may be used to using Visual Studio. If you are, that's fine. I didn't mention it, but Visual Studio is a fine advanced product, and that one should work fine, and of course, that certainly would be available on System 7. So if you're not using Eclipse but prefer Visual Studio, I haven't personally used it, but it's been around long enough, and we're not doing anything super fancy. One thing about Studio, whoever uses it, do you know if it supports Ant? Okay, I'll be showing that. That might be a slight disadvantage, but I would think if it's that advanced, it would have to. Ant is coded in Java, and it's sort of meant to coexist with it, and we'll get into that. So let's get back to these notes. And somebody asked, are these available yet? And the answer is no, since I was working on them this afternoon, thinking about what it is I wanted to say. But what I'll do is I'll take all these when I get back, maybe not tonight, but the next day or two, scan them, put them up in a file, and send you my initial message to Piazza saying that the extended notes are up so that you can see the handwritten stuff as well as these. What I typically do is I have the preset set of notes that I know I want to cover, but things are boiling in my mind from what people have asked and what's been going right and wrong, so I usually add some extra stuff at the last minute to make it as topical as I can. So let's get back to what the project was. We have this language called CSX Lite, and what we're going to do is give you a working scanner and parser. Hey, that's generous, but later on you'll figure out how to make those. The reason for that is, in combination, the scanner and parser will build a very, very important data structure called an abstract syntax tree. In fact, let me write that down. We'll get to it. And that's abbreviated AST. And AST is what we, as compiler people, believe a valid program looks like. For most people, what's a program? It's just a series of characters in a file. The problem with that is that there's all sorts of things that are characters in files that aren't programs and probably never should be programs. It's just, you can get up a document, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Anybody know what that is? Excuse me? It's a tale of two cities. It's the only one where I know the first line and the last line situation. And non-technical, I guess. It's a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done. It's a far, far better rest I go to than I have ever known. So you get a little bit of culture here as well as computing. They always think us computer guys are all hacks. But it turns out that prose is very powerful. But in fact, it's sometimes too powerful. What we want in a program and a program specification is very detailed definitions of what's valid or not, and very specific definitions of what we want done or not. So we can't have something where we write a program and it's pretty vague about what's going on. Human language loves that. Politicians really love that. But programmers don't. We want a program to know exactly what it's going to do as we write it. It may not do what we want, and if the language is badly designed, it may do unexpected things. Language design is full of all sorts of bad things that took a while to figure out. In fact, since some of you already know Java, most of you do, and some of you may have learned C or C++, you know that a common if statement form is if dot, dot, dot. And that says if A is equal to B, dot, dot, dot. But it turns out that if you have an engineering or mathematic background, you're not going to write that to say if A is equal to B. In earlier languages, you would write down, and this is in a C language, for example. It turns out that if you are primarily an engineer or scientist, someone who knows mathematics, you said, okay, if A is equal to B, equal is the comparison operator. In C, and in fact to this day, if I write that down, that may be accepted, but guess what? It's not going to do a comparison of A equals B. Does anybody who knows any C know what it's going to do? What it's going to do? It's going to do an assignment, because in the earliest languages, equal was not a comparison operator. It was an assignment. And in the earliest versions of C, and in so many of them, what this would do is say, well, A equals B is an expression. It's not true in our language. It's not true in Java. It probably shouldn't be, but in C it was. And it says, as a side effect, assign B to A and return as the value of the expression the value you just assigned. And guess what? In C, you didn't need to have a Boolean value controlling an if statement. You could use an integer. You could use a pointer. And the usual rule was, if it's zero, that's false. Anything else is true. So if I assign, if A equals B, and A and B happen to be one, it's, I'm going to assign one to one. One is true, so this thing ends up true. If A and B are zero, I assign zero to zero, return zero. It turns out that's false. So what you assigned or what you compared made a difference in a very unexpected way, since one is equal to one and zero is equal to zero. So it took people a long time to figure out that you could write down something that C says, hey, great code, love it, but it's not what you wanted. And that's one of the biggest problems in coding, is writing down something and not getting what you wanted. And I'll give examples of that, but it's still an ongoing problem. So we're going to give you a working scanner and parser to build an AST. You know something about what CSX Lite is, but guess what? You don't have to worry about handling invalid programs. So if you guess wrong and said, I thought CSX allowed it, CSX Lite allows this, it doesn't matter. It's not a valid program. It's not something that we'll test you on. We'll only test you on valid programs, and the scanner and parser will tell you about valid programs. Even better, when we build the AST, it'll tell you precisely what the program is and what it isn't. So a lot of this course will be centered around the AST. First couple of projects, we'll build it. Your project will use it. Later on, we'll analyze it and generate code from it. So it's our specification in a very precise form of what valid programs are. If an AST for it exists, it's valid. If one doesn't exist, it's invalid. It might be a great idea. Maybe we should allow it. But if the rules say it's invalid, we don't worry about it. So what you're going to do then is walk the AST to gather information about declarations and uses, as I've talking about. Finally, an example. So here's a very simple program. It's got two scopes, an inner scope and an outer scope. Remember, the rule is in an inner scope, you're allowed to redefine identifiers. If they clash with the outer scope, that's okay. The inner definition takes precedence. That's done so in huge programs, you can write a bit of code and have your own local definition and not worrying about stepping on anybody else's toes. In your domain, your rules apply. Outside that, your rules are not visible, and you don't worry about it. So this is a very simple one that has an integer defined in the outer scope, so-called global scope, and one defined in the inner scope. And it's simply assigning the one gets the other. Reasonable program, turns out to be a valid program. The reason we know it's valid is because we have an AST for it. And here's where that definition in the assignment I gave you comes into play. Each of these little nodes represents an abstract syntax tree node as defined on pages 3 and 4. In the definition, it gives you precisely what's there, but now we can see what in tree form valid programs look like. You always have a root saying, I'm a CSX Lite program. So this is a CSX Lite. Many of these have the word node in them. I abbreviated that out. Just node to remind us that it's an AST tree node. What do AST programs represent? In this case, it has declarations and uses. So declaration says I can be one or more, or zero or more, actually, field declarations, and my body can be one or more, or actually zero or more statements. What's a field declaration? Well, it turns out our definition of a field declaration becomes a valid variable declaration. So I can declare a variable. What's a variable? It has three components. One is the name of the identifier as a string. The second one is either integer or Boolean. And the third one is always null. This little box with a slash through it represents a special node called the null node. Null node says you could have had something there, but chose not to. Now, one of the important things in ASTs are we never have null references in an AST. Why? Well, one of the most common errors in the world is trying to use a null reference. What happens when you try to use a null reference in Java? The Java system pulls you out in the hall and shoots you. Says you made a mistake, it's fatal. It means you die. So what do we do instead? We say, if there's a case where you don't want something, there will still be a valid reference to a node that says, I'm null. What's in the null node? Nothing. Seems like a waste, but of course, we've got tons of memory these days, so that's not an issue. And it guarantees that the tree is always complete. You can always walk to a node. Null nodes, typically, you say, do something, and the effect is to immediately return. No harm, no foul. You go there, and it works. So what this thing is saying is in our little program, we have one variable declaration. The guy's called A, and he's type int. No other declarations because we have those null nodes there. How did you know to put them there? You didn't. The parser did. That's the cool part so far. You don't have to worry about exactly how these trees go together, just that we'll give you a valid tree and understanding what they mean. And one of the things is a null node simply says, I could have had something there, but I didn't. So in the full language, we could have an initializer. CSS Lite does not have an initializer, so that'll always be null in our simple little language. Field declarations, notice there's an S following that, says I could have multiple declarations. If I had a second declaration, it would go right there, but I didn't. So I have a null node saying, I'm done. Statements, it says, well, a statement can be an if statement, an assignment statement, or a block. It says my statement would be a block. How did I know that? Well, the parser saw those braces, and that says, oh, I'm doing a block. What's a block? It's a miniscope that has declarations, zero or more, and statements, zero or more. So it says, what's my field declarations? It's another variable declaration, this time B, and its type is int. That's all the declarations I have. Oop, should have put a slash there. And statements, I have exactly one statement. It's an assignment. It says, and an assignment has a source and a target. Both of those can be identifiers. This little identifier says, I'm a node of type identifier, and my name is B or A. And that's all the statements we have. So this is a complete AST node for this very simple program. Now what's going to happen is you're going to write code that analyzes this. Let me skip myself out of order. I will just leave it here. So what I've given you, and we'll look at it in Eclipse in a moment, is I gave you a working program that actually walks an AST. But it does something a little simpler than what we're asking. If it did exactly what we were asking, where's the fun of that? You don't get to code anything. You don't get to make all sorts of mistakes and call me all sorts of obscene names. So in this case, we're going to do a simpler problem that will simply count the number of declarations and the number of uses in its scope. It's not going to do any matching of declarations and uses. That is, it's not going to have a symbol table. That's what you're going to add, and I'll talk about that in Oh, that's alive. He bought me a couple. Before class, I was given a couple of boxes of batteries, and I think I know why now. Back alive? Yeah, cool. So what I've given you is essentially a solution to a simpler problem, but still a problem that's very relevant. You're going to still walk the tree, and particularly you're going to look for identifiers. How do you do that? Well, each node you say, do you involve an identifier? Typically that means it'll have a component that's an identifier. If it doesn't, it may have children. You may call the child and say, you don't have anything to do about identifiers. I don't, I should say, but maybe my child does, so I'll examine it. And again, the code is available. I'll show you that, and you can trace it. In fact, one of the things you might want to do is trace that example I had earlier. We'll show you about what it would do. But basically, all this tracing is going to do is keep track of scopes. Each time it sees a curly brace, like there or there, but it's not going to see a curly brace. It's going to see either a CSX light node or a block node, which is the representation of the brace. It's going to say, I'm opening a new scope. So it's going to keep track of those. Just number them, 1, 2, 3, etc. Each one of those will be defined on a line. So in our case, lines 1 and 3 is where they were defined. And it's going to remember how many declarations and how many uses I saw in that block. How do you know if it's a declaration? Well, there's a node that says, I'm a variable declaration node. That's a declaration. The other places where an identifier is used, that says I'm an identifier use. So in this particular case, it would walk the tree and say, oh, I've seen a scope beginning on line 1. It has 2 declarations, and it has no uses. Why no uses? Well, the uses in the inner scope are grabbed by it. This is a very simple analysis. It says, if you're used in a given scope, you belong to that scope, even though there's a containing scope. That's an oversimplification, but it's a reasonable starting point. So it says, A and B were declared in the outer scope, but they were never used there. They were used in an inner scope. It says there's a second scope, and that's on line 3. It has 1 declaration, namely C, and 3 identifiers in its body are seen, A, B, and C, and it counts all of them. So all it does is walk the tree looking for identifiers. It says, what scope am I in? And it says, am I declaration? Increase the declaration count. Am I a use? Increase the declaration, the use count. And when you come back, I have a data structure that contains all this information. I write a 2-string routine that prints it out in string format, and I'm done. So that's essentially what we want you to do to get started. But it's not the full solution. So let me get you ahead on that so anybody who wants to get started straight away can do so. What you're going to need to do to go from my solution, which doesn't count where declarations occur, just where they appear, and tie them into use, is something called a symbol table. A symbol table is easily implemented as a hash table. That's a built-in data structure in Java, or a widely used one. And what it does is maps identifiers to information. The information typically is a class, and in a class you can keep track of what you want. So in this particular case, we'd bring a symbol table that would say, for the outer scope, I have 1 declaration. I think I have an example of that. Yeah. I have an outer scope. I have a declaration of A. And in the inner scope, I have a declaration of B. Now, we're going to guarantee you there are no scoping errors in our programs that we test. That means variables will always be properly declared somewhere. It might be in an inner scope. It might be in an outer scope. But it will be declared. And there will be no multiple declarations. If you want to improve upon that as extra credit, you can handle those 2 errors, which are admittedly common. Namely, somebody forgot to declare an identifier. That's common because you mistyped something and you thought you typed this, but it isn't and it didn't match. Or you had a multiple declaration, you changed your mind and you forgot to pull the earlier declaration. So both of those are errors. So we're going to go ahead and do lookup on those. And let me give you an example of that. And we will come back to this in later lectures. So each scope will have a symbol table, and we'll link those together. So a block-structured symbol table is a linked series of hash tables, each of which contains information about an identifier and its usages. So in this particular case, we had 2 scopes. That's my earlier example. And they're linked together. I'm calling them inner and outer. Inner comes first because you always check from the inside scope to containing scopes, finally to the outermost scope. So in the inner scope, it says, I have 1 declaration B, and it links to information that says I'm Boolean. It probably would have extra information about line numbers. I'm not showing that because I don't want to clutter things. And it has a second scope that says, I have a definition outer that says I'm an int. So what happens is, when we see a usage, declarations creates a declaration inside the current scope. When I see a usage like B, it says, tell me something about B, namely, where was it declared? And that's what we'll actually do in our compiler. So it says, let's try the inner scope. Is there anybody named B in the inner scope? answer is yes or no. What happens is if you do a lookup and it doesn't find anything, it'll return you the null pointer. It says, give me a reference to something, but it wasn't there. So you look up B and says, hey, he was there. And moreover, his type is Boolean. Therefore, this definition of Boolean is the one that I want to augment to say, here I found a use for it on line such and such. So in the definition of Boolean, it says, hey, there was a use of B on that line. I see the A, and it says, let's look up A. It's in an outer scope, and it says, hey, my type was integer. So it says, even though A is an inner scope, the usage was on the outer scope. So it says, A, I found a usage of you and line, whatever that line number happens to be. It'll track that. So that's basically conceptually what we're going to have you do. Let me... Oh, did it do it again? It's getting there. Ah, there we go. So this is my version of Eclipse. Again, yours may look a little different. There's so many versions out there. They all pretty much work. So this is the one I had. So let's go ahead and... There we go. So I'll show you about importing something. So I'm going to switch the workspace so I get what looks like yours, which initially be empty. That was my test case. All right, epic. So what it's doing is it's changing my workspace just so I can mimic what you would be doing. So you're starting out fresh and you don't have any projects. So the first thing you want to do is import a project. This is that zip file I talked about. What you would do is you would download it from using a browser to some location on your machine. And under File and Import... General. Now, one of the odd things is, and it always screws me up, is that you would think it would you would select an archive file, but you don't. You select an existing project into the workspace. What I'm going to do is, I think I have it on my desktop. So what I did is I put it into a desktop file. So this is mimicking, you just have available this project. So there it is. And it imports that. And don't worry about this message. Yeah, that's just part of the build. So what happens here is that this is what I've given you to start. And let's see what's in there. You click on this. SRC stands for source, and it's the default package. Now what's happened is there are a number of Java files in there. Those are the only things you'll have to change in terms of doing your program. There may be some extra tests and so on. I'll illustrate that. But essentially, let's look down these files, and this is written also in the specification. So at the very top, ast.java, that's something you will have to change. What you'll have to do is change what I have in the various AST nodes, and I'll show you that in a moment, from doing the simple counting to do the thing that actually maps a declaration with a usage, so I have a complete cross-reference. So let's look at that. So this is a listing of what's in there, and let's just find a typical node and here's a good one. So I'm inside a var decl node, and inside each of the AST nodes, there will be a definition of the method I'm implementing, or alternatively, in my parent node, there may be a default declaration. Oftentimes, if you don't want to do anything, you define a null body and just import it. But here's a good example. I had a var decl node, and it says, remember what my solution is doing, it's counting declarations. So here's the little method that says count declarations and uses right there. And I'm giving it a parameter that says here's scope info. I'll show you scope info, but that's the information about scopes, namely counting their usages. And it says in this case, well, what's the declaration doing? It can do only one thing. It's a declaration. It's got to be correct. It's doing one more declaration. So whatever my count was, initially starting at zero, it's incremented. So it says, take my current count declarations and plus equal it. That is incremented by one. So I saw this declaration. It says, hey, I found a declaration. Let's find a use. Here's something. It says, here's a declaration for statements. That's one statement followed by additional statements. Well, what about identifiers? It's not talking about identifiers per se, but my statements may have identifiers in them. So in those cases, it says, how do I do this? Well, I'm going to take my first child, which is this statement, a single statement, and tell it to go ahead and count all the declarations and uses it has using the current scope I have. It would then say, if there are additional statements, go ahead and count those. So I do my left child, my right child, and whatever increments appear get returned back up to me. So what you'll want to do is print this out, I would think, and look at all the places where identifiers are used or possibly reached as children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren and see where the counts go. Essentially, what happens is you'll visit the parent. It'll work its way down, visiting the children. You'll increment the counts each time you see an identifier use or declaration, and then you'll work your way back up. When I return to the parent node, that's the CSX Lite node, here's the one I had. So what this thing did is this started all out. It created a new scope list. We'll talk about scopes in a moment. It visited all the declarations, processing all those, visited all the statements, processing all those. And it says, hey, I'm done. I have a data structure. It contains a linked list of scopes. And each scope that says, here's my scope number, here's my location, and here's how many declarations and uses I have. But how do I see that? I'm a human. That's just the data structure. It's invisible. So what I do is I have a toString, and what this toString does is it walks the data structure, printing it out into character format or converting it to character format, and that's what's returned. And that's the output that we'll see, and I'll show you that in just a moment. So that's where you'll spend a lot of work. You want to first understand how it's doing the counting of declarations and uses, and then you want to change that. You can leave that one in there, but you're going to need a new one that does essentially the cross-reference creation. We have p1.java. This one has very little change. What this is the starting point of the program. So it reads in the file that's going to be compiled, does some error testing, and so on. And the only thing you'll need to change there is that right over here, it says, please count declarations and uses. You're going to change that to go ahead and please create the cross-references. So that'll have a tiny little change. The parser is automatically given to you. Don't touch that. You don't need to. Scanner is already given to you. Don't need to touch it. You can look at it if you want. It may be readable or not. It doesn't matter. Scope info is important. Here's the data structure I use to add this information. So scope info has a number. Am I the first scope, the second scope, and so on? What line number did it appear on? Line 1, line 10, line 100? Give me the count of declarations. Give me the count of uses. And because scopes may be nested inside other scopes, I'm going to link them together. So I have the first scope, the second, and so on. That means when I print it, I'll first say scope 1, here's my info. Scope 2, here's my info, etc., down the list. And then I have some methods that manipulate these, constructors and so on. You'll probably want to look at those, but once you understand what's going on, you'll be safe there. Sim.java, don't change it. Unparsing, don't change it. Visitor, don't change it. So basically what you're going to need to do is do a lot of work on AST.java, a tiny little bit of work on P1.java, and scope info, you might want to create a related class that does scopes with hash tables rather than linked lists. So you'll need to do some work there. So when we got all this together, I talked about this business about ANT. So let me show you a little bit about that. What turns out is for complex programs, doing things in the right order, that is build the scanner and then build the parser, then compile this, then compile that, can be complex. So what happens is we have a file called build.xml that it knows about that contains the information, and it has an option called run as. Now be careful here, because run as has ant build, you don't want that, you want ant build dot dot dot. And I don't know why they have the two of them, but that's the way it is. And it'll bring up a thing that says, here are all the various builds I can do. The very first one I'll do is a clean. And clean says, let's initialize me to the initial state as I'm starting out. The stuff down towards the bottom, let me adjust that up a little bit. Oh, no, yeah. Getting this stupid cursor. Come on, guy. I usually use a mouse, but I don't know. Okay. Well, let's look at this a little bit here. What it did is it went ahead and did essentially the cleanup. That's minor. Let's go back and look at build again. So I just did that one to initialize stuff, run as ant build. And now I'll run a test. Turn off clean. What test will do is compile and then test. When you're doing your project, you first probably want to just compile, get past the compilation errors, and then do the testing. This thing is running by quickly, so if I can see if I can coax this guy into, please, please, please move yourself up. Ah, there we go. Thank you. So what this thing did is, and when you first install this, you might want to try this, is it first went ahead and compiled. Look at that, 41 source files. Why did it have so many source files? Well, because there are a lot of subclasses and because each AST node is its own class. So if you see a big number like that, don't let it frighten you. Most of those are pre-declared. So it's compiled all those, and it says, here's the program I want you to analyze. And what it does is print out the AST. Well, how does it print out an AST? Turns out there's a special routine which I gave you called an unparser. Just as a parser changes from text to an AST, an unparser reverses that, goes from an AST to the actual input, or something that's equivalent to the input. So it says, here's the program you gave me, and here are the line numbers it's on, and so on. Sometimes I'll have separate physical line numbers that have the same logical line number. That just means in the source file, I had multiple declarations on the same line. This thing pre-prints it to make it more readable, and in this case, you follow the line numbers that are written down. So it says, okay, here's what happened in this one. It says scope one, which began at line 2, had 6 declarations. You can count them down there. and it had 11 identifier uses. Scope 2, which was down here on line 11, had one declaration. That's easy to see. That's the Boolean. And it had, in this case, three identifier uses. So it's doing just what I showed. And you can toy around with this a little bit and get going on it. So if you're using Eclipse, import the archive, play with the build file. You don't need to immediately. You could just use a plain run, but eventually you will. So you probably should get used to the build file. Look at what you already have, and then start changing it. What I would recommend is changing it bit by bit. That is, fix up one AST node, and then another, and another, and another, until you've done them all. That way, you'll be able to do things incrementally. If you make a mistake, you'll be able to localize it. So I think that's all I wanted necessarily to say about the Eclipse import. You may have questions that ain't come to mind right now that we probably ought to answer right now.
Mm-hmm. If you have the folder name as it was in the zip file where it has startup, it gives you an error saying that you can't find the XML. And then if you take that off, it looks like it's looking for CS536 project one without startup. If you take the startup tag off, then it can't find the file. It's an individual.
But it's something that once you do the initial clean, it cleans itself up. Or does it? Okay. Yeah. So, you know, you're right. I've seen that too. And that may mean it's referencing the original build file instead of the copied in one. And there's a way to change that, and it's one of these Eclipse type things. So you're absolutely right there. It's using the original. As long as you don't change the build file, I think you're fine. But I think you're right. It's referencing a build file outside of the archive. And I don't know of any simple way to make it use the build file in there. You'd think it would. But it's somehow has built in on the run system where to find the thing. So you're absolutely right on that. So I don't think you'll get in trouble on it, but it's doing something a little unexpected, at least for me. Any other questions or comments? Okay, that's all I needed to say about that now. So you'll probably want to try Eclipse or whatever other mechanism you use fairly soon. Okay, so I'm done talking about Project One now. We'll maybe talk about it in Piazza or on our next meeting a week from today. So what I get back to now is we've been throwing all kinds of terminology at you, and it's unfamiliar. So now I want to give you originally the 10,000-foot view, then the 1,000-foot view, and then the up-close-and-personal kind of view. So you've all heard of compilers, presumably. You use them in previous courses. Certainly, you use them when you're doing the data structures. And I guess, what compiler did Jeff use? C or C++? Yeah, so, and they certainly have compilers. So different languages, but not as different as you might imagine. But from 10,000 feet, the programming language as what? Nothing more than a series of characters on a line. In fact, you've never done it, but it's possible in almost all programming languages to write a program that is a single line. That is, the line feeds normally don't mean anything. There are a couple languages where they do. Indentation occasionally means something. Someone was talking to me about Python. There's a case where it does matter. But languages are so primitive in some ways that a straight sequence of characters, sort of like on a ticker tape if you see old movies, would be a valid way to represent a program. Eclipse does way better. That's why it has the two-dimensional view and the formatting and all. But our view of programming languages is very low level. We feed in character by character by character. The compiler groups them together, builds that AST I talked about, analyzes it, and hopefully, if it's a valid program, gives you something as output that's executable, that is in machine language. What does machine language mean? Well, all computers have an underlying language that it understands. Very primitive instructions, typically things like add two numbers, compare two numbers, conditionally execute this sequence of instructions rather than that, read something from memory, store something in the memory. Very, very simple. But it has one overwhelming advantage. Namely, these things are fast. How fast? Well, this is a brand new machine, and it was sold at as having a 1.3 gigahertz processor. Well, what does that mean? First of all, we're all in the technical things. What does a giga mean? Billions. And hertz is typically used in cycles. That's not hertz like my back hurts, but hertz like Heinrich Hertz, who did early science in electromagnetism. What it's saying is, ideally, this computer processor, this little old me have, I'm not the president, I'm not, you know, the owner of Epic, able to spend millions and millions at a whim. This thing says that, in theory, this guy could execute instructions at the rate of 1.3 billion instructions per second. Now, they don't always do that because there are limitations. Getting at to memory is much slower, depending on where it is in memory. We're all into the cloud now. Does Epic have cloud products? Yeah, probably. If not right now, soon. Cloud is really cool. But when the first thing you hear about cloud, what should come in your mind is slow. Why? Well, cloud means the data is way out there somewhere. But why is it important? If it's way out there somewhere, it probably means it's off-site. If it's off-site, how do we get to it? Probably the internet. But it's even worse than the internet. It's the internet connected through communication satellites. What's the thing about communication satellites that should worry us? Well, first of all, how high up is a communication satellite? Somebody in a spacecraft, an astronaut or cosmonaut, is only up a couple of hundred miles. How high is a communication satellite? It's about 50,000 miles. It's very high. It has to be high enough because it has to rotate slowly enough that it seems to be overhead at the same spot continuously. So if it's up 50,000 miles, that means if I shoot a request up to the satellite and down, that's 100,000 miles. If I come back and get a reply, that's 200,000 miles. Now, when you studied physics, what was the speed of light? 186,262 miles per second. So we're talking about, if you go to a communication satellite and come down and go up and down again, you've burned up something like a second. But I have a processor that can do 1.3 billion instructions per second. So there's a lot of cool research going on about the cloud. But the one thing to remember about the cloud is, if you get a lot of data from the cloud, you're going to spend some time doing it. And I'm sure people doing cloud research are well aware of that. So that's the constant trade-off we play. We have these unbelievably powerful processors, but they have to go out and get so much data and so much contact from somewhere, and how to mitigate all that. So that's one of the things we'll be looking at. So that's our 10,000-foot view. Virtually everybody who uses a computer or programs computer knows about this. So we're going to do better. Well, first of all, we're going to talk about a little about why people love compilers, although I guess, you know, sometimes I think that's self-evident. So one of the cool things about compilers is you don't need to know the details of the underlying machine. Most of you are probably running on an x86, an Intel processor. If you're running on a tablet or running on a smartphone, you're probably running on an ARM. In the old days, they used to have Power PCs and Sparks and lots of other kinds of processors. Hardly anybody remembers those details because you don't need to. There's some smart guys like you and me who figured out how to go from a source language like C or Java or Python down into the language the machine understands. That means that you need to know about the source language and the jobs you're doing, but you don't need to know about the machines. In theory, they could take out all the processors you have from x86s to something else, and your programs would still run if the compilers have been updated. So that's why that's so central. Compilers, like Eclipse particularly, also try to help you with errors. There's a lot of silly things you can do where the compiler says, this looks awful funny. You may, for example, have a declaration that nobody uses, or you may have a computation that looks like it's probably not going to do what you intended to do. The compiler may help warn you about that. The trouble with warnings is if you get too many of them, they become nagging. And we all know what happens when you get nagged too much. You turn it off, yes, dear, no, dear, of course, dear, and that's the end of that. So if you give warnings, you have to give them judiciously. You can also use compiler technology for security. That's something that you people may be interested in, certainly other people are. One of the odd things about computing is that most computer users are immensely naive. What do I mean by that? Well, most of you, or many of you, are probably Wisconsin natives. When you were growing up, did your parents lock the door during the day or overnight? You don't have to, I won't ask your name or your parents' location. The answer is, for many of you, they didn't. I grew up in the center city of Buffalo, and boy, God, did we lock the door. If I would take the door, open the door and let the dog out for the backyard to do what a dog has to do in the backyard, I would come up there and my mother would say, "You left the door unlocked. You know, somebody could have come in and robbed her," and all that. So some people are security conscious and others aren't. But look at the problems we have with programs. Every time you see a web page, it's, "Oh, please download me. Click in, this will happen or that will happen. Click and we'll tell you what your credit score is," or "Click, we'll tell you how to save money on taxes," or "The best way to find an El Cheapo flight to Bermuda or California or Hawaii or Miami Beach or wherever." But when you click those things, you know what's happening is you're inviting a program into your house. You don't know if it's a nice, friendly little collie dog or, you know, like it's a killer pit bull, you know, and you may find out too late. So one of the things that people have been looking into is ways to mark programs that are easy to detect as being safe or unsafe. How would you know they're safe? Well, one of the things they'd be doing, it's a genuine Epic product. I don't know, does Epic have any problem with counterfeiting where somebody sells a false product under your name? Certainly Microsoft and other folks do. I don't think you're at that stage yet. Maybe eventually you will. I mean, today, big companies, tomorrow, everybody's going to have in their pocket an Epic product that does all cool things. You know, watches their health, contacts their doctor, warns them they're drinking or eating too much or exercising too little or whatever. Big Brother with a big E on it. So, situation there. So, it'll be important at some stage that not only do you write programs that are demonstrably confidence, something that I have faith that I'll run, otherwise I may not. Compilers actually have other issues too. I don't know if it's true for your products, but there are certain products that succeed because they've come up with a remarkably clever way of doing something way better than someone else. Makes it more compact, faster, more reliable. But here's the problem. I have to give you that code. Suppose I've got the world's fastest game. And of course, none of you ever play games, I realize that. But something that runs, you know, like a knife, hot knife through butter, you know, really super, super fast. And nobody else can get that to work. But you're selling it. That means somebody gets the code, they can go ahead and reverse engineer, and they may be able to figure out what the trick is that you did to make it run so fast. Immediately that happens, you know, that's going to be stolen. If not here, stolen by somebody who doesn't respect copyright laws. So how can you do that? Well, some compilers actually write programs and translate them into a confusing manner, in a manner that's hard to follow. We won't be talking about that in detail, but it's a cool idea. It's called obfuscation, assuming I can pronounce it. It's also possible to watermark programs so that if I claim this is a valid program, a watermark is something, you know, you hold up a piece of paper and you see an image saying this is genuine banknote or genuine bond paper. People looked into ways of doing that for a program. For example, I can ask a program a question. You know, what is your favorite software product? And if it comes back Microsoft this or Microsoft that, it says yes. If it doesn't come back Microsoft this or Microsoft that, it says fake. I don't believe it. So that's all there. And something else that turns out to be particularly topical, you may have seen this silly little thing down here. I didn't bother to turn it off because I wanted to mention it today. I happen to have one little old laptop, but why do I have four of those little stacks going up and down, up and down? Many of you maybe have even more. Some of you can have 8 or even 16. So what do those little stacks represent? Actually, in this case, two of them are processor cores and two of them are threads. So these days, things have gotten so good that when I buy a computer, I don't buy one computer, I buy two. That is, I have on one chip two different processor cores, each of which is a totally independent processor. What's happening is processors are so fancy, they can do not just one thing, they can do two things simultaneously. So in this particular thing, you can see a couple of things are running, and most of the other things are doing nothing because I'm just talking and not asking it to do stuff. The question is, as we go from 4 to 8 to 16, how are we going to utilize all this? We have the ability to do all this extra computing, but how do we get a program to utilize it? You say, well, we write a parallel program, but that's way easier said than done. Parallel programs are hard to get done right, and it's an ongoing situation. I don't know. Do Epic Products try to use concurrency at all? I'm an outsider. Maybe they do. They do. They probably should. So it's an ongoing problem of how to use concurrency effectively and safely. The problem with concurrency is if you have too many things going on simultaneously, it's exactly like you and your roommates back when you were in college trying to use the bathroom or the kitchen at the same time. You're in there, you know, you're in there showering, everything's great, and your roommate decides to do what? Go to the bathroom. And in a lot of homes, you hear that flush. What's the first thing you do is you dive out of the stream. Because seconds after, you know, that flush goes on, what happens? Your stream used to have balanced hot and cold water. Now the cold water is going down the toilet and the hot water isn't. So you know what happens. So this sort of thing actually happens in computing where steps that should be independent are getting on each other's toes. And it's oftentimes hard to coordinate them. So that's something that is an ongoing problem. We're not going to solve that in our class, but it's something which you'll see in future and ought to be aware of. Always like to talk a little bit about history. The history of computing goes back, for compiling at least, back to the 1950s by a most remarkable woman, Grace Murray Hopper. If you've never heard of her, I suggest when you have a little free time, look up the Wikipedia article on her. I met her one time, totally remarkable woman. She, for example, is given credit as one of the persons who either invented or popularized the word debugging. And many of you probably heard the story. Where did the word debugging originally come from? That's right. They back in the old days, computers were actually done with vacuum tubes, and apparently some sort of bug like a moth got into the wiring, landed on something, and got fried because they used fairly high voltage, and shorted the thing out. So before you could use a computer, you had to remove the dead bugs, which was debugging, and it got carried on to removing errors. So she invented that term, which is now very well established. She invented the term compiler. And one of the other things, she was, and probably still is, the oldest serving naval officer in the United States Navy. Now, this is a woman who was a computing expert, never got involved with battles. How would it be that she outlived all these fancy admirals, 3, 4, 5-star, I guess there must be 5-star admirals? What's the secret if you want to be in the Navy and last a long, long time? That was her life, and you know, she saw herself as an officer and didn't want to retire. Who outranks a 5-star admiral? And they only go as high as 5 stars in U.S. Navy. The commander-in-chief, but man, she wasn't on good terms with him, but politicians, congressmen. She had the congressmen, they loved her. So every time it would happen that the Navy wanted an appropriation, one of the guys on the chairman of the committee would say, hey, you're not thinking about retiring Admiral Hopper, are you? You really do want this appropriation, don't you? And turned out she served well into her 80s. Remarkable, and did a very credible job. I met her one time. She would come out and give tours at various campuses, and people would get a chance to meet her. So she, remarkable person. And she coined the term compilation as the way to build a program out of pieces. Compilers go back to the 1950s. And one of the sad things, perhaps, is that the very first compiler that was really successful was Fortran. That's good. What's bad is there are still Fortran programs out there. Not the same version of Fortran, Fortran 77, Fortran 90-something, but Fortran is still a very viable language. Particularly if you're a scientist or engineer, you may be programming in Fortran. So does that mean we've done our job well or done our job poorly? Here it is 60 years after the invention of the language. It's still being used. There aren't too many things that last 60 years in the high-tech world, and it turns out that Fortran was one of them. So that's one of the things we as computer scientists have to worry about. Although I won't talk about it, one of the early concerns about programming was using the machine effectively. Early machines were way, 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 way less capable than today's machines are. And it was important you got every last component working properly and thoroughly and completely. So people worried about optimization. We worry a little less about that, and I'll talk more about that when I talk about virtual machines, but it is still something that people worry about. So we're going to do something that is fairly topical, but it's something I want to explain before we get too deep into it. Namely, we're not going to generate target machine code for the machines you're running on, which are probably x86 boxes. If anybody's ever looked at x86 assembly language or machine language, it is awful. I just had a colleague saying he was looking at it again and he could barely stand, open the book and look at it. What's happened instead is that we've had people design virtual machines. Now, what does virtual mean is we act as if it's real, but it's actually simulated. If you ever saw Star Trek, and who hasn't, you see virtual reality all the time. You go on a holodeck, you know, and you could have all the sort of things with virtual players. So it's something which I hope to see in the future. Maybe I won't live to see it, but you will. But in terms of virtual machine, people design a machine that is executable, that's designed specifically for Java. What happens is when it's implemented, it's not actually run in hardware. It's run in software very effectively on top of the hardware. And that is the advantage that the Java virtual machine can run on a wide variety of machine architectures. That means your Java program can run on any underlying processor, can run on a tablet if you have a tablet that supports Java, even on a smartphone, if the smartphone supports Java, and many of them do. So it's possible to do that. That slows down your program, but it turns out people have worked on optimizations that find where a program is slowest and actually work on tuning it to make that part of the program fast, letting the other parts be slow. So it's the old bottleneck principle that a couple of spots are key, the rest really don't matter. So there are a variety of advantages to virtual instructions. You're able to have them match the language precisely. Turns out in Java that's very useful. It's possible to enhance transportability immensely because you're writing in Java and Java virtual code, not on a particular machine. So are you writing on a Mac? Doesn't matter. Running on System 7? Doesn't matter. Running on a Unix or Linux? Doesn't matter. It'll run on any and all of them. I don't use ARMs too often, but ARMs presumably also support Java and would run on them too. You may also decrease the size of a program. I think that's more wishful thinking than reality, but it's at least something that's conceivable. Okay, finally we get around to structure of the compiler. What's going to turn out is you're going to be doing five components, as I've warned you, but it's going to turn out there's really going to be in two pieces. The first piece, let me get some clean paper here and find a good pen. There she is. It's always underneath something. So you're going to actually be doing two different steps, and it's the first step that you're going to be doing will be through the scanner, the parser, and partially your first project will be analysis. And that's going to be looking at a program. Remember, programs are just series of characters. So now, was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Is that a valid program? You're going to have to actually look at that and break it down and saying, what's this trying to say? So what you'll first do is break down the characters, each individual one, into things called tokens. Those are essentially the little words of language. So if I see the word T-H-E, I'm smart enough to know that I'm not seeing T followed by H followed by E, but rather those three letters meld together into a single word called the. If I see something like a comma or a semicolon, if I see an uppercase or a lowercase, I know that means something. It's true also in languages. So if I have a language, I might say something like if A, B, C equals 1, 2, 3. And it's going to be up to the scanner component to say, well, he didn't write down I followed by F. He wrote down a special word that's predefined called if. And that's called a reserved word. It's called a reserved word because you may not have an identifier named if. That makes sense because why would you want them? But again, in the early days of programming languages, people did not have reserved words. What did that mean? Well, you could write down a program in the early languages that looks something like this. If, then, else. Now, I'm not stuttering. I didn't get hit on the head and see double vision. What they would say in there is that we'd have identifiers, and they weren't reserved words. They were called keywords. We'd let them coexist. So in that language, and the language I'm thinking of is called PL1. It goes way back, but it was a major a major exercise by IBM when IBM was king of the hill. IBM isn't in the language definition business much anymore. Maybe this is why. But they would say, here's if, that means the conditional if. You could have a variable named if you want. So if, second if could be a Boolean variable. Then is the then part of a statement. And you could have a subroutine called then. And in some of the versions, if then did not have parameters, you did not have to say, give empty parentheses. I guess this would actually have a semicolon there, but that's okay. And similarly for the else. So if, then, else, else. Would you want to write in a programming language like that? I mean, that is so begging for insanity that we got around and said, okay, we're going to redefine things to be a little more precise. So in more modern languages, I know the if ends because I have a paren, and parens are not allowed to be parts of identifiers. I then see ABC. That is all run together into one identifier. It sees double equal. It's smart enough to know that it's not two assignment equals, but it's one double equal, which is a comparison operator, then 1, 2, 3, which is a literal, and close parens. So it's able to take individual characters, apply the rules of the programming language, and come up with something that makes a sensible sequence of words, which I will then try to fit into the patterns that valid programming statements adhere to. So that's analysis. After analysis is something called synthesis. Synthesis says, after I spent a lot of effort figuring out, is the program correct? Ooh. Let me finish my thought and we'll take one more break. And is anybody there? And then we'll be out of here. So what synthesis does say, if I have a valid program, let's go ahead and transform it from the user's point of view into something that a computer can actually execute. And I think that's a good point to take a little break. So it's about 15 past. Oh, that's great, because I was figuring to let you out about 8:30. So why don't we take a 10 or 15 minute break approaching 8 o'clock, and then we'll have one final mini session until 8:30. And then if anybody ordered the pizza or whatever, how long is the kitchen open? Is the kitchen still baking pizza? No, too bad. Okay, too bad. So we'll see you in about 10 or 15 minutes, and I'll save the battery.